What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Welcome to another episode of Strictly Business, the podcast in which we speak with some of the brightest minds working in the media business today. I'm Andrew Wallenstein with Variety. The critically acclaimed drama series Pachinko wraps up its first season on Apple TV this week. It's just the latest buzzworthy show to come out of Media Res, an independent studio led by my next guest. Michael Ellenberg is also producer of The Morning Show and Scenes from a Marriage, among others. And he's here to talk about what it's been like to sell series in this streaming-heavy world in just a moment. We're back with Michael Ellenberg of Media Res, the company behind Pachinko, The Morning Show, and a lot more. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. I'm excited to be here.
Great. So you launched back in 2017 with backing from Bronze Studios. So your company's coming up on its fifth anniversary. And I wanted to know how your expectations of how this was going to go squared with your actual experience. Was it tougher, crazier? Look back for me.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, it's like a first period closing. I would say, you know, when you start a business, almost everything is surprising. You know, there's what was accurate in terms of the business lens, there were things we were super right about, and then all the execution's much trickier. The thing, okay. The basic premise was, you know, when my tenure at HBO, I'd been there for 5 years. And when I started there, you know, Netflix had bought House of Cards, but it wasn't like an important player yet in series. Hulu did what, like none of these players, all the players that we are so define us didn't matter. By the time I left, you know, Netflix was, you know, maybe the lead buyer at the time. Amazon had emerged, Hulu, et cetera. And I had one simple business idea, which is that there will be more of that than less in the future. Right. And Apple would come on and the landscape of this would explode. We'd only glimpsed how big it was going to become. And I think that's, you know, even now, 5 years later, it's still not clear what the end is, right? Meaning there's still further growth, further appetite, further demand. There's shift in emphasis for all these players. So the basic premise of there's going to be a lot of series ordered, and if you can be a supplier in that environment, great. And also that there would be a need for a company like mine, which was, you know, the simple idea of MediaRes. A few things. One, there are a few simple ideas. One, it'd be great for creators to have a home to do their best work, to do really innovative work and really distinct work, and kind of incubate the project fully before going to market. And that you need sophisticated suppliers for these streamers because they can only do so much themselves. And if you could both manage these projects well, manage the process well for both the creators and the network, people would be glad to have you. I was always looking, you know, when I was at HBO, it was always be nice to have a company on the other end of the phone who could, you know, who got what we wanted and could do it, right? And so, and you know, you have enough fires going every day when you're a network exec, and even more so now, every network exec has, like, when you talk to them, they have 20 shows going. So you'd like a couple where you don't have to put the fires out, right? So those were sort of, yeah, those sort of simple premises, and create a really unique creative home. And so that's been, so the market, you know, the market's been fertile and big, and then everything else has been much more complicated and trickier to pull off, but, you know, we'll continue from there.
And as you mentioned, you've worked on the other side of the fence at HBO. You developed some pretty big shows there, Westworld, True Detective. So now that you're on the other side of the fence, how is it different? How is the market different? Are you operating in more of a seller's market than when you were at HBO?
I mean, it's way more so. You know, the way it's, you know, there used to be, as you know, really one buyer for these kinds of shows. Now, you know, we're entering, you know, we're in the consolidated era, so we're down to five or six buyers. But for the really big stuff, there were never that many networks, right? Like, so there's way more than there used to be. And so if you have the right elements involved, you have either the right IP, the right star, the right element, whatever it is, or the right just concept, you can still create a big market frenzy as a seller. But these buyers are also quite, quite powerful. So I doubt they would refer to it as a seller's market. I think they feel like they have plenty of control over the outcome right now.
And I would imagine that control is only going to grow in, as you referred to, this consolidated marketplace. HBO now, of course, part of a whole new conglomerate set up at Warner Brothers Discovery. So how does your company hold its own, get the best terms for itself in a world where they're getting bigger and more powerful on the other side of the negotiation table?
You know, I think that by sticking to basics is the truth, Andrew, which is there's only, whether there's 10,000 shows, 50 shows, you know, it doesn't really matter. There's always only so many that are really good, right? There's always, and I don't know that the volume of things ordered actually changes things that much in that regard. So, so if you stick to basics, you know, which is for us, it's, you know, what's, you know, we look at white spaces, what's not on the air, what's interesting to us. The basic question the company asks, from myself to my assistant, to the interns, to Lindsay Springer, our great head of creative, is first and foremost, if it was on the Netflix screen, the Apple screen, whatever screen, would we click on that tile first, right? And if the answer is yes, we're all hard to please consumers with widely varied backgrounds. If the answer for us is yes, the odds are it will be yes for a lot of other people. So what we try to do is find both unique voices with something to say and saying in a new way. And if you bring that to market, buyers get excited. You know, I mean, they want to be stimulated too. They are pitched this. This is an era where being really different is better than being slightly similar. You know, and that's not always the case in Hollywood. And so as long as you're bringing something that's special, unique, and they feel, we try to put a lot of love and care into what we do. We don't go to market very often. So I think when we come to market, people take it seriously. Whether they buy it or not is a different question, but I think they can always tell we've given a lot of thought and care to it.
So being different, I would imagine, gets harder in a marketplace that is as cluttered as it is. And yet, you know, let's talk about Pachinko, which there's not a lot of projects like this multi-generational, trilingual epic. I mean, to me, that sort of errs on the other side of, could something be too different? What gave you the confidence to take a risk on something like this?
Okay, so difference is sometimes in the eye of the beholder, right? So obviously Pachinko is quite different than anything market in a kind of broad sense, particularly in the American sense. But you know, if you're paying attention to K-drama and Korean content in general, K-dramas have been huge, not just in Korea, but globally for quite a long time, well past 5 years ago.
But not in the US market, at least for a time.
For a time, right, and then the burgeoning, but you could see that happening. But they were big in many other territories, and I will say, a small focus group, my mother. So non-Korean speakers have been watching them. And so what was exciting, so the book was beautiful and great. And it seemed also like a unique opportunity, to build a premium audience where if you could draw from a Korean audience, an American audience, maybe a Japanese audience, Asian American, and other emigres around the world, you could build a meaningful hit across multiple territories, right? So it didn't have to be ginormous in any one space if it did well in all these various spaces, and then the rest of the world is gravy potentially, right? And so there was a business logic to it. And then there was this more simple thing, which is a story like this had never been told, and yet it's quite universal. You know, you don't have to look far around the world right now to see stories of war, displacement, refugees, family separation, and unique explorations of identity and family. And so even though this was an incredibly specific story, I guess I felt a strong conviction, and we felt in the company, that you could, in both honoring this Korean story, Zainichi story, that if you got that actually truthfully, if you execute that in a truthful, authentic manner, it would not only speak directly to the people it's about, but everyone else would see themselves in it too. And in a way, the book was the test, which is the book was a bestseller well beyond those markets, right? So if people were willing to read the book who weren't from that background, our belief was people would be able, would want to watch the show as well.
Well, it's certainly resonating with audiences. It's certainly resonating with critics. I've never seen, it goes back years, the kind of critic response that this show has gotten. So I got to imagine Apple TV may want more of something like Pachinko. Is that even possible, given that you sort of drew this from the book? Or are you able to go forward with the story this?
The series only covers kind of the first. Sue Hugh had this brilliant approach, which was to intercut kind of past and present of the novel together.
And we should explain, Sue is the one who adapted the book.
Oh, sorry. Sue Hugh is our showrunner and adapter, and really essential to us believing we could pull this thing off. So we actually only finish a portion of the events of the book in season one. So we think, yeah, there's plenty more story to tell going forward and Sue's expanded on events in the novel already, and she'll continue to do so, but we have plenty in the novel to still cover.
Got it. Of course, Pachinko is not the only show you've got on Apple TV. There's The Morning Show, which is currently working on a third season that I guess will come out at some point, perhaps next year. The Morning Show, I think, whereas Pachinko, you know, universal critical praise, The Morning Show, I think, has had a more polarizing response. I'm curious if that's how you see it, and is that a problem as you go into a third season that you intend to fix? I know there's a new showrunner. Just want to get a sense of how you look at where that show is going in its third season.
Yeah, I mean, I take, I think everyone who, you know, who does, well, I shouldn't say that. I take critical response pretty seriously, and you don't want to over-index to it, right? Because you want to learn from it and get a feel for it. At the same time, the show has a huge audience. It's hugely loved, and you feel that love. So you try to listen to a lot of sources, both critics, audiences, friends, industry, and kind of get it's a gestalt feel of, is it working? And then I've had all to my work over the years, the stuff I've worked on, all range of critical response. And you always take it seriously. At the same time, you can't take it too seriously because you got to move forward and do what you do. What you do want to chase for The Morning Show, certainly we're going to chase in season three, which is, you know, keep it relevant, provocative, entertaining, but also, you know, it's a loved show, you know, and so and has a deep, and the audience has a deep connection to these characters and to this world. We've done very well in the awards nominations this year. Guilds and our peers really love the show. And so that matters a lot too. I don't know that critics, they're not that inclined to also revisit these things over time. You can chase your tail a little bit if you over into it.
I also wanted to get a sense of what it's like working with Apple TV, which, you know, I think has, contrary to the rest of Apple, a reputation that's sort of more like up and coming as opposed to the big giant dominant player in this space. But they've got some real heat now, thanks to some of your shows, thanks to an Oscar win. What is it like? Have you seen an evolution in working with Apple TV over this time?
Yeah, Apple's been an amazing partner for this company. And it's well said, like they're the, for an established company as Apple is, the TV Plus is the scrappy upstart. And so for Media Res, which is scrappy upstart, I think we've had a certain synergistic and like-minded approach. They're growing, they're maturing, hopefully we all, as you build on your work, and they've been staffing up so rapidly, they get more and more sophisticated and more capable, and their ambitions are only growing, and that's exciting. And they're, what's really cool about them, and it's I feel very fortunate for Media Res in this regard, which is when you're part of a company like that that's exploding and growing, they're ambitious and they're not tied to what they've done. You're not tied to a lot of rules about what has to have been. We've always had success this way. They're making the rules up as they go along. And if you're working with them, you get to be a part of that, of designing the system. And that's just a rare and neat opportunity. And they're global ambitions, just like every streamer are large, and they're moving more and more in that direction. So, they've been amazing partners. They're cool.
And of course, it's not your only partner. You're working with other networks and streaming services. What I'm wondering though is, my guess is back in your days at HBO, there was something different about selling to HBO and what HBO's creative needs are, what Showtime's needs are, FX's. I don't know that I'm necessarily seeing much differentiation in the current landscape. It just seems like because of the volume of all the content out there, everybody's buying everything. Am I reading it wrong? Do you get a clear sense of like, no, this company's looking for X, this company's looking for Y?
I think, Andrew, it's super well stated your question. I think what's probably more relevant now about the streamers is what they share in common, right, in that regard. Which is, they're all doing sufficient volume that it's hard to say there's with some exceptions at each place, but that there's really a show that would only land somewhere. That said, these companies, we believe in the human factor, like human beings matter. The human beings who do these jobs matter. And when you're working with them, they're not Netflix, the giant corporation, or Apple, the giant corporation. There are a few human beings on the other end of the Zoom, or hopefully at the other end of the meeting in person at some point again. And in that, there's variation. And so when you're putting shows together, you are looking for the right champion for your creator, for the show, for the project. And those different, they're human beings in each place, and they have their quirks and their specific sensibilities, and they're all pretty bright. But they have things they fall in love with. And so if you're in Media Res's shoes, we're looking for the champion for each thing who's going to love it enough and care about it to nurture you through these giant machines, right? Because that's what creators need in those buildings.
We're going to learn more about Media Res in just a moment. We'll be back with Michael Ellenberg. And we are back with Michael Ellenberg of the production studio Media Res, maker of shows like Pachinko and The Morning Show. Michael, Media Res recently announced an expansion into the nonfiction space. What drove your decision to expand into this?
First and foremost, we simply like these shows, right? And so a lot of our scripted work has actually been based on nonfiction stories. Morning Show, most famously, I had a concept for this show, but then optioned Brian Stelter's book, Top of the Morning. So we use the real world to inspire a lot of our material, and it just seemed like a logical evolution to say, okay, well, we're building a lot of fiction out of this work. Maybe we should just tell the truth of it. And then similarly, these show, both doc series and doc films, are more and more vital to the networks. And as a consumer, I wish there was more premium doc series. And so I thought, well, rather than we thought rather than wait for more of them to be made, we should help make some of those. So that's the impetus for us.
But is there a difference in terms of selling scripted and selling docus? Is there a bigger appetite? It certainly seems more of this content is particularly on the streaming services than ever.
Yeah, I think when HBO really innovated in this space 20 years ago now, they believed in the space artistically, but it was a brand halo. I think they've been pretty open about that. It was a means of building a kind of brand identity more than an audience play. And then I think what's, again, one of the amazing things about this era is these films are accessible, the series are accessible, and they're huge. People watch them. They drive viewership. You feel in your own lives, in your own conversations you're having. So,
definitely.
Yeah. So how they're packaged, how they're sold, it'd be good to have a music label right now. It seems that there is no end to the music doc appetite. But it's also, I view it from a Crave perspective, pretty similarly to when premium series exploded, which is, kind of what genres haven't been done yet, and there's plenty in doc series in particular, I think, that haven't been explored yet, and arenas to still to innovate in, and so it's similar in that you want to be in if you've got the new thing that really stands out, the market moves, and they need to, for us at least, we really want everything to have a cinematic value, cinematic television and a kind of cinematic sheen to it. So we're always looking for exceptional filmmakers as well to partner in this space. You're also competing with the great production value of modern scripted series. And so you don't want a kind of collapse when you watch a doc series anymore, I think.
Do you have any concerns, though, whether we're talking about scripted or unscripted, about maybe an end to this boom? You saw, for instance, last quarter, Zaslav over at Warner Brothers Discovery saying, hey, we're gonna increase spending, but not necessarily all that much. Do you feel there's a point where finally the number starts to hit a ceiling?
I think you're seeing for each individual company, and certainly what you're reading about with each individual company, they'll hit some plateau probably in the United States. And then what's clear is the rest of the world is wide open, right? So I think as we look forward, I don't know that for the kinds of shows we focus on, I don't feel much of a limit hitting. Because if you're at the high end of the market, I think there's going to be plenty of demand going forward. It's just a maturing market. But outside of the U.S., I don't think it's clear at all what the end of that will look like. I think we're just at the early stages of what international expansion looks like.
And does an English language producing content player like yourself look out at this broader global marketplace? And could you get into things like local programming, understanding that there's no such thing really as local anymore? Everything travels. But are you that far into this where you're saying, you know what, I could make this work in the UK. I could make this work in Asia.
Yes, is the answer. You want to, we have a sensibility here that we think matters abroad, and Pachinko is a piece of that. And so at least for now, yeah, we think we could do more abroad. You want to be looking, I think there's local language, which no longer matters. I think there's a difference between whether you're building a show that you really, are only looking to succeed in a local territory versus a show that you think can succeed globally. And so for us, we're going to be looking for shows that we think can work all around the world, whether they're in English language or other languages. I think what Pachinko represents is a kind of merger of approaches, a kind of American style production and showrunner model with an international production in a foreign language series. And I think it speaks, that's why it's connecting so much globally.
We're seeing companies like your own in the independent production space, like Hello Sunshine or Westbrook, selling all or parts of themselves for big bucks. Is that where Media Res is headed?
We're going to be open to growth opportunities. If it allows us to do not just more, but do better, then for sure, you know, I mean, we like what we do. We like making things and we like making good things. And so we're going to be open to opportunities where we can expand our reach in ways that we think can still maintain the quality we've been striving for.
And is scaling with the ability to meet the demand in the marketplace, I can imagine MediaRes probably as a company has grown from, well, you tell me, you know, a handful of people to 100. Like, give me a sense of how you've been able to grow this thing quickly.
Yeah, we're not that big yet, but we've grown a lot. That's correct. And there's always a tension between sort of volume and quality. But we think we can do quite a bit more volume before we've hit that wall. And, you know, you go show by show, you know, like we've built I don't necessarily recommend it, but I don't know if there's another way to do it. Some of it's, yes, you're building the plane as you're flying it or the car as you're driving it. Pick your tortured transportation metaphor. But we're in a growth era. And so I don't think whether you're a company of MediaRes size, Apple TV Plus, or Netflix for that matter. I think everyone's in a similar boat, which is you're trying to meet demand. You're trying to, as you make new shows or new films, you know, build the staff as you're doing it. And there's labor shortages everywhere in the economy right now. And so it's a pain in the derriere, Andrew.
What else is coming up for you? I know, for instance, you've got a deal with Boots Riley for a project, and I would imagine just the sheer volume of what you're working on is increasing.
Yeah, so I'm actually in New Orleans right now. We're filming Boots Riley's show here and in Oakland, which is great. And then we're doing that for Amazon Prime, and we don't have released it yet. We haven't wrapped yet. And then we're also in post on our series for Apple's that Scott Burns created called Extrapolations, which is, I think, one of the first huge scale series that looks at human changes to climate changes. And really, Scott's put together an unbelievable cast on that show. And I think it's a pretty visionary series that we're quite excited about as well.
How does a show about climate change work? Because on the one hand, obviously, it's one of the biggest subjects out there. It's also sort of a very tough subject, something that I wonder, you know, can it really translate to entertainment? Is there a way you're sort of navigating that balance?
Yeah, it's very early. So we haven't spoke. I mean, we've announced the show and obviously, but we haven't done any press yet. And so I want to let Scott speak for his show first. But yeah, I think that's why we took it on. I think, everyone at the company believes that the public's engaged by the events and reality of the day, you know? And so you have to find intelligent, unique stories that tell you something you don't know. If you're simply telling, whether it's if you're being topical, if you're simply letting people know about the event, then there's no reason to watch. But I think Scott's found a pretty unique way in to look at human responses to these events. So it's less about how the climate changes, more about how we change, who we are. I think people will be pretty moved by it. And you'll be on a ride with some pretty amazing actors and lots of bells. Yeah, we give lots of bells and whistles along with it, Andrew. So yeah, I think so. Don't Look Up is a good example, by the way, that was a humongous movie for Netflix and a ton of people watched it. And that film literally ends with the end of the world. So I feel like we're way more optimistic than that already. We believe you should assume the audience is smart. Assume they're smarter than you. And you'll be rewarded for that. I think I think audiences like to be challenged. I don't like to assume the audience is any different than you or me, meaning like we like to be challenged, we like to be inspired, and we like, you know, and depends on your mood. Sometimes you wanna lean back and zone out, but you know, plenty of the time you wanna lean in. I think much more of the audience is that way than we sometimes give them credit for.
Well, looking forward to seeing Extrapolations and a whole lot more from MediaRes. Thank you, Michael, for taking the time out to talk to me today.
Thank you, Andrew, so much. It was really a pleasure.
This has been another episode of Strictly Business. Tune in next week for another helping of scintillating conversation with media movers and shakers. And please make sure you subscribe to the podcast to hear future episodes. Also, leave a review in Apple Podcasts and let us know how we're doing.